got a few objectives we're going to talk about. First, we're going to define end-stage liver disease. Then we're going to define some of the palliative needs of these patients. We're going to describe the effects of hepatic dysfunction on your basic symptom management that you'll encounter as palliative physicians. And then we're going to examine the concurrent care model as it applies to these end-stage liver disease patients. So before we dive in, I'm going to have you think about a couple cases as we're learning the information. The first is you have a 45-year-old woman. She has a history of alcoholic cirrhosis, complicated by hepatic encephalopathy and varices. So have her in your mind. Next patient is a 67-year-old man. He has NASH cirrhosis, and his is complicated by recurrent ascites. So little differences between cirrhosis and end-stage liver disease. So cirrhosis describes the pattern of repeated injury leading to progressive fibrosis of the liver. It can be caused by a number of etiologies. Some of the most common in the United States are viral hepatitis, alcohol, and non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And then end-stage liver disease is defined as cirrhosis with the presence of a few disease-defining complications, including ascites, refractory ascites, varices, jaundice, and encephalopathy. Sometimes you'll also see people with hepatocellular carcinoma, defined as end-stage liver disease, but you really need those four complications to truly define it. So in the United States, end-stage liver disease cirrhosis, decompensated cirrhosis specifically, has a prevalence of about 600,000 people in the United States. And in the age group of 25 to 64, it's the seventh leading cause of death. So you deal with people with cirrhosis, there's about 26,000 deaths per year with the addition of hepatocellular carcinoma, which contributes to 18,000 deaths per year. And so while it's not the leading cause of death, it's certainly a cause of morbidity and mortality in the patients you're going to see. So prognosis can be a little difficult, a little bit challenging to delineate for these patients. So we use a few parameters, and that's something that has really evolved over the years as more and more of these patients come about and more information is studied about them. So it used to be that we used the Child-Turcotte-Pugh classification. There were some subjective measures in there that didn't exactly lend themselves to the most objective delineation of a patient's prognosis. So about 15, 20 years ago, a model for end-stage liver disease was presented as a way to delineate who would receive a liver transplant. And so it utilizes INR, utilizes creatinine, it utilizes bilirubin, and there have been some additions over the years utilizing sodium. But what it does is it designates what is your expected three-month prognosis, and using that is used to allocate livers. So frailty has also been proposed as a way to look at prognosis for these patients. It's an area of increasing research, increasing study. As you can see in numerous disease states, people who are more frail, people who go into a hospitalization with a lower performance status tend to do worse. And then there's the distinction between patients with compensated cirrhosis and decompensated cirrhosis. Compensated meaning that the liver is cirrhotic, they may not have symptoms and they may not even know that they have liver disease. Usually, and it's hard to define these because if you don't know you have it, it's hard to know what your true prognosis is. That's been quoted in the literature as 6 to 12 year survival, but there's a pretty wide range. Whereas decompensated cirrhosis, so a patient with cirrhosis who has one of these complications or has a decrease in their overall health due to their cirrhosis, their prognosis tends to be more on the order of 2 years, which you can then delineate even further based on which type of complication they had, whether it's refractory encephalopathy or refractory ascites, which tends to have a little bit longer prognosis as it's uncomfortable but doesn't tend to be life-threatening unless you have respiratory complications that that come from that. Whereas hepatorenal syndrome portends a far worse prognosis, especially type 1 hepatorenal syndrome, where you're dealing with maybe even weeks to months or less. Then there are a number of other complications, just general illness stemming from the progressive underlying liver disease, whether that's people who develop respiratory failure, septic shock, life-threatening GI bleeds that can also portend a worse prognosis. So then liver transplant is really the only treatment modality we have that confers any sort of meaningful survival benefit. If you look at the 10-year survival in a patient with end-stage liver disease without a liver transplant, the survival rate is 0%. So someone who gets diagnosed with decompensated cirrhosis will, in all likelihood, save for maybe some outliers, be dead within 10 years, which is pretty staggering when you think about it. Whereas patients who receive a liver transplant, the 10-year survival is 60 to 70%, which is pretty good. And then that survival rate is improving as technology improves, as medication management improves, and just as general health healthcare improves through the years. There's a lot of waitlist data that gets compiled as far as the number of transplants, the median wait time, and the mortality. And over the past few years, the number of patients on the waitlist has increased, but supply really hasn't. So you have a fairly fixed number of organs that get donated. So you have a far larger number of patients who are either still on the wait list year after year, who become too sick to be transplanted, too sick to undergo their transplant, and who get removed from the wait list. And you have far higher numbers who never get captured, who don't get waitlisted at all because they are too sick. And as I mentioned, the mortality is quite high if you don't get a liver transplant. So just in briefly describing the underlying disease process, you as palliative physicians can start to pick out what are some palliative needs of these patients. So as far back as the late 90s, when the support data was coming out about how patients were dying in the hospital, and then some subgroup analysis of these cirrhotic patients, started to become apparent that these patients had pretty high palliative needs. And there's been some improvement through the years. We'll go through some literature later in the talk. We're still kind of stuck. And so back in that 90s period, started to be some talk in the literature about what is this high cost of end-stage liver disease? Honestly, not even keeping palliative in the picture, just thinking about the true cost, both monetary and then to patients and their lives. So as this increased awareness of the burden of disease started to become apparent in the literature, so did the role of palliative in patients without malignant diseases. So as you see more and more hospice for non-cancer diagnoses in the literature in the late 90s, early 2000s, again, starts to come up, well, what about these patients? What about these patients with end-stage liver disease? I alluded to the support data, which really highlighted the disability that these patients have, the poor quality of life, and really the abysmal CPR survival that these patients sustained while they were in the hospital during their terminal hospitalization. And then if you think about it, there's quite a few peritransplant needs. So even patients who are going to receive a transplant or do receive a transplant have substantial psychosocial support needs, physical, psychological symptom needs, and then sometimes transplants don't go well. There's complications after the fact, or another illness comes about, and there can be some end-of-life needs that are ripe for some palliative intervention. So as I alluded to, you've got physical symptoms, so pain, fatigue, muscle cramps, dyspnea, that are really difficult to treat at baseline, let alone in somebody who has end-stage liver disease, for reasons we'll get into shortly. You have a number of psychological symptoms, confusion, depression, anxiety, and then just the overall uncertainty of dealing with a life-limiting illness. There's advanced care planning needs, specifically in patients with end-stage liver disease who are prone to confusion, hepatic encephalopathy. It's essential that they designate a surrogate, whether that's confirming that their legal next of kin is who they would want to speak for them, or designating a specific healthcare power of attorney. Then there's a number of end-of-life care needs, location of care, symptoms at end-of-life, difficulties with different medications in these patients. And as I mentioned, both pre- and post-transplant, there are roles for palliative providers. So thinking about symptom management in these patients, there are some things to keep in mind. We have just the general symptoms that all patients who have life-limiting illness might encounter, the pain, shortness of breath, anxiety. And then there are some symptoms that are specific to these patients, specific to this disease process. We're also going to talk a little bit about the effects of hepatic dysfunction on symptom medications, as I mentioned. And then we'll talk a little bit about my recommendations, some practice patterns. You'll find that there's not a lot of literature specifically guiding what you do, so a lot of it is based on provider preference and experience. So cirrhosis and pain. So you've encountered patients with end-stage liver disease in the hospital. some don't have pain. A lot of patients do have abdominal pain, especially if they have rapidly reaccumulating ascites, if they have hepatocellular carcinoma. If you think about the kind of abdominal stretch that comes with this rapidly accumulating fluid, or the stretch that can happen hepatic capsule when you have a tumor, there's a lot of patients who can have discomfort and pain, let alone patients who have spontaneous bacterial peritonitis, painful condition. There are a few treatment challenges. One is altered drug metabolism. Patients with livers that don't work well have difficulty processing medications, or just have considerations when you're dealing with the dosing and the frequency. There's substance use. It's a problem for a lot of patients with end-stage liver disease, whether it's substance use in their past, alcohol, other substances, or current can inform which medications are the safest to use. And then encephalopathy, the dreaded encephalopathy. Not only are you dealing with somebody who already has some issues with confusion, but people are hesitant to give potentially mind-altering medications to a patient that's kind of on the edge of being confused at all times. So looking at this chart at some of our commonly used opioids, I broke it down into the phase one, phase two type of metabolism, and then there's a couple that have both, and we'll go into why we would pick one over the other. And we may have talked about this in prior discussions, but the ones that you see a lot of and the ones that I tend to counsel hepatologists and other physicians away from is oxycodone. So you see patients on relatively low doses of oxycodone, but oxycodone is metabolized through the 2D6 pathway and can tend to accumulate when people have decreased hepatic metabolism and can lead to increased exposure to drug. So if you are going to use oxycodone, wanting to decrease the dose, potentially decrease the frequency, and at the very least monitor closely for side effects. Methadone is a medication that you can use in end-stage liver disease. It is phase one. It goes through multiple CYP pathways, multiple cytochrome P450 pathways. So if you have some that are knocked out, ostensibly you'll have others that are still functional. It's something that you may want to use with caution, and again, monitor very closely. Fentanyl boluses are really the safest, the one that have been shown in the literature to be the safest. It is phase one, but based on its unique pharmacokinetics, it's generally used safely. Whereas continuous dosing, so a fentanyl infusion or fentanyl patch, really hasn't been studied in the literature, and I'd really use caution when using this medication. And then similar to oxycodone, hydrocodone is another one that I would avoid or use with caution. Additionally, hydrocodone only comes with your Tylenol, so you're really limited to 2 grams of Tylenol or acetaminophen per day, which can drastically limit the amount that you can utilize. We'll skip over tramadol and buprenorphine briefly, just go to morphine and hydromorphone. Again, those are ones that you wouldn't necessarily want to avoid, but you'd use with caution. Both are metabolized through the liver and then excreted renally. So where I would tend to counsel teams that morphine or hydromorphone would be more acceptable than something like oxycodone is if you do have preserved renal function. When you get into hepatic and renal dysfunction, you may want to choose a different medication. Like I mentioned, push fentanyl. So if you're dealing with something oral, tend to go with the oral Dilaudid if at all possible. Again, lowest effective dose. You may even want to stretch out the frequency because you're ostensibly going to have more drug in your system for longer than that 4-hour half-life. The problem being, there's really no way to know specifically how long any one person is going to have. It's really patient by patient. And then talking about tramadol and buprenorphine, we do use buprenorphine for pain. The thing to think about is if you're using Suboxone or one of the other combination products that has naloxone, a decreased hepatic clearance of the naloxone can lead to really high levels of it, the little bit that you do get absorbed. So it's something to again, use with caution, use with some pharmacy input. And then tramadol. Tramadol is used pretty preferentially by some of our colleagues for pain in these patients because it doesn't tend to cause the same hepatic encephalopathy that you see with other opioids. But there's a reason for that, because tramadol is a prodrug and it requires a functional liver to actually get your analgesic effect. And so the reason it doesn't cause the side effect is because it's not causing the intended effect either. So I always tell my colleagues that I would really avoid tramadol unless it's very, very much working for the patient. In any case, because of tramadol's myriad other issues with side effects and other metabolic pathways and other effects, I tend to avoid it altogether. And then there are some adjuvant medications to think about as you're taking care of these patients, trying to optimize these as much as possible to minimize your opioid use. But again, dealing with some considerable issues to have in mind when you're coming up with a treatment plan. As I mentioned a little bit earlier, so acetaminophen, also a go-to, and it is a good medication. You can use it safely in these patients. It's generally thought up to 2 grams per day or 2,000 milligrams per day in patients with end-stage liver disease. It has both phase 1 and phase 2 metabolism. As you can see, extended half-life. And so, as I mentioned, the recommendation is to reduce the dose. NSAIDs are generally avoided in these patients, not necessarily because of the effect on the liver or the effect on the metabolism, but it's the bleeding risk. So you have these patients who have gastroesophageal varices or bleeding, gastropathy, and who are already at high risk for bleeding, are at risk for platelet dysfunction in the setting of potentially splenomegaly from their end-stage liver disease, all sorts of reasons why a bleeding risk would be something you'd want to avoid. So TCAs are another medication that you generally want to avoid, again, because of the effects that are because of the increased bioavailability. Anytime you have a reduction in the amount of metabolism within the liver, you're going to have more drug available, and so you're going to have increased exposure to the side effect profile. So the recommendation is to reduce the dose if you need to use these medications. SSRIs and SNRIs are medications we use quite a bit in these patients, but again, reduced clearance, extended half-life. So the recommendations are to reduce the dose and the frequency. Start low, titrate up as you need to. The one to avoid in end-stage liver disease is duloxetine. It's been associated with fulminant liver failure, so it's best just to avoid it, which is unfortunate because duloxetine is a good medication. So anxiety and depression, alluded to it in that previous slide about patients who are on SNRIs, SSRIs. It's a common symptom. It's a common symptom for everybody, let alone patients who are dealing with serious, potentially life-limiting illnesses. So the antidepressants, the anxiolytics, just like with everything else, likely will need dose and frequency reduction, mostly to reduce the risk of side effects. You want to hit that minimally effective dose so that you're getting the benefit that you're hoping for and minimizing that risk profile. So now we'll get into some of the symptoms that are specific to these patients. And one of the most distressing and one of the most difficult to manage at times is hepatic encephalopathy. So long story short, we actually don't know a lot about what causes hepatic encephalopathy. There's been some increase in the literature. It is a neuropsychiatric symptom. It's thought to be associated with elevated ammonia in the blood, potentially related to GABA activity in the CNS. But really, we don't know the exact mechanism. So the management tends to be correcting an underlying cause if you can find it, whether that's infection, whether that's medication effects, whether that's bleeding, whether that's decompensation of their cirrhosis, trying to fix the underlying problem, as with any sort of delirium type state. Then lactulose is the drug of choice to start with. It is cheap, it is relatively easy to take, although it's like drinking medicinal syrup. Some patients like it, some patients don't. Titrating to 3 to 4 bowel movements per day, which can be very disruptive for a patient at baseline, let alone someone who's frail, who maybe needs help going to the bathroom, who has issues with falls, that can cause a lot of issues. And so if either lactulose isn't working or isn't tolerated, there are a number of other medications that you can use. They tend to be expensive, so rifaximin is a non-absorbed antibiotic that's a lot of times not covered by insurance and can be pretty expensive, but can generally be helpful. So refractory ascites, another symptom that patients deal a lot with in this patient population. So generally the management is trying to reverse any reversible causes. So sodium restriction, fluid restriction. If part of the reason you're getting fluid accumulation is because of dietary indiscretion, try to fix the dietary indiscretion. Utilizing diuretics, trying to optimize those as much as possible. Now, generally, that's going to be done by a patient's hepatologist, by a patient's gastroenterologist, but it's something to think about as you're working in conjunction with these teams. If you're having refractory ascites and you're having difficulty controlling the discomfort, got to try to control the ascites, which they'll likely already be doing. You can also utilize serial large volume paracenteses, which can be helpful, but tend to stop working for longer periods of time, need to increase the frequency, and that can be a burden for patients to be coming in from home to either into the hospital or into the outpatient setting. Even if they're relatively mobile, it can be pretty burdensome. And then plus or minus albumin if you're doing large, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 liter volume paracenteses, you're gonna need to work in conjunction with hepatologists for that as well to make sure that you're not dealing with massive fluid shifts that can cause problems with the kidneys. There are some shunt procedures, including TIPS. Again, gonna be managed by the hepatologist, but it's good to know that we've exhausted, if we have exhausted, disease-directed therapy before we start utilizing our heavy-duty symptom meds. And then peritoneal drains, which are, I think, a great option for patients who are maybe leaning toward or who are already on a more comfort-focused care path. I think a lot of proceduralists and a lot of specialists are concerned, rightly so, about the infection risk that having an indwelling drain can confer. And that's why usually if patients are on a comfort care path, that risk is acceptable because the benefit is so great. Patients and their families can drain the drain at home without having to come in and out of the hospital. So that can be managed with some home care assistance or with hospice services. Other symptoms you might encounter with these patients, insomnia, you get a lot of sleep-wake cycle reversal, thought to be due to accumulation of neurotransmitters and neurologically active side effects of not having adequate metabolism from your liver, as well as fatigue, just generalized fatigue, making it difficult to do much of anything. You get a lot of sarcopenia, a lot of protein calorie malnutrition leading to this. As well as with muscle cramps, you get a lot of fluid shifts, electrolyte shifts with your diuretics, can lead to a lot of uncomfortable muscular complaints. And then pruritus, which can be an extremely difficult symptom to manage just at baseline, again, let alone when a patient is dealing with hepatic dysfunction, because a lot of the medications we utilize for pruritus are very sedating, and patients and physicians are often hesitant to go forward with those medications. There's been some study of ursodiol as a more disease-directed option, but doesn't work necessarily in everybody. So now that we've talked about some of the symptoms that you'll deal with, some of the kind of physical, psychological issues that could utilize some palliative intervention for these patients, we'll talk a little bit about the barriers to incorporating palliative care into these patient populations. And this is by no means an exhaustive list, but these are the general themes that emerge in the literature over the past, I'd say, 20-25 years or so. So prognostic uncertainty. We talked a little bit about the difficulty in prognosticating these patients. You have some general guidelines, but any patient is different and could, just like with other chronic organ failures, could have good times, very sharp declines, don't know if we're going to get back up to our baseline. And so it's difficult, not only for patients and families, but for their physicians and their providers to really know, is this patient in a terminal phase? Do they have years left? A lot of times we just don't know, or we feel uncomfortable with how much we don't know. There's delayed referral. Again, going back to this prognostic uncertainty, if palliative has generally been seen as an end-of-life care, a lot of times patients don't get referred until they're nearing or at that phase in their illness. And while we can be of great assistance during that time, there's a lot of time upstream in their illness process that we could have been providing some of these palliative supports. And so talking to providers, talking to physicians, trying to figure out how do we move some of those referrals upstream. It's difficult to talk about goals of care when you're still pursuing a cure. It's one of the tricky parts about transplant as an entity is you've got this specter of, I could be cured of my illness, but why am I talking about death and dying? Why am I talking about morbidity and being in the hospital and changing my life if I'm really focused on this cure? And we know as palliative providers, it doesn't have to be one or the other, it can be both. But a lot of times it's hard to wrap your mind around that as a patient, as a physician. As I mentioned, some provider practice patterns. Some specialists, some physicians have trained in an era where palliative wasn't integrated into the care of these patients and may not be as comfortable with co-management. Some people have trained at institutions where palliative is very well integrated and they consult palliative a lot, and somewhere in between. And so it's difficult and it can be very provider dependent about how much palliative is incorporated. There's also issues with access. It's not just, oh, the physician didn't consult me. It's a lot of times in smaller or less academic centers, you may not have the same robust palliative services where they're available to non-cancer patients, or they're available in the outpatient setting where these kinds of conversations are really best had. And so there's a call for really exploring what are these models for delivery? How do we optimize this delivery for these patients? And then even though there's been literature over the last 20, 25 years, there's still a lack of an evidence base. Most of the literature has been started out letters to the editor, some retrospective chart reviews, some literature reviews. There have been a few prospective studies, but it's still a relatively new area of work. And so a lot of the evidence base that exists for other disease processes just doesn't exist yet. Yet is the key phrase. And so looking at some of the key literature, there have been, as I mentioned, some themes that have come about. So you've got Hansen et al. Looking at patients pre-transplant, looking at their palliative needs. Punja et al. In 2014 had a pretty stark retrospective review of their patients who were denied liver transplant, looking at the percentages, looking at the referral patterns to palliative. So for patients who were denied liver transplant, so who are by definition in a terminal phase, who are not going to be cured of their illness, who have a limited prognosis, only 11% within their system had palliative consults. And many were very late in the process, as in nearing the end of life. Now, that's one center. It's by no means a generalizable pattern, but it's pretty eye-opening. We're talking about incorporating earlier and earlier, and if we can't even get incorporated toward the end, then we've got some work to do. And then Beck had a really interesting survey study in 2016 that looked at both nurses and trainees and attending physicians, and looked at their own feelings, their own knowledge, attitudes, and practices toward palliative consultation. And I think one of the most enlightening piece was that attendings self-identified as a barrier to consult, which it was pretty interesting. And then Kathpalia in 2016 had a similar study to Punja in 2014, again looking at delayed or absent consults in patients with end-stage liver disease. So that's just a snapshot. There have been many more that have shown, not enough consults, not enough penetrance. There's a lot of work to be done. And there has been some work in the literature that's looked at maybe some new, unique, creative models of how to deliver this care to these patients, or looking at the way we even talk about palliative, the way we talk about hospice in these patients. And maybe there's some room to grow in this kind of joint venture. So Rosaro et al. In 2004 at, I believe UC Davis, talked about in a letter to the editor of their combined team. So they had patients who were referred for liver transplant and then utilizing MELD, not only for allocation of livers or putting them on the list, but also for hospice referral and some joint support of these patients with both disease directive and palliative care. And then Medici et al., same group, in 2008 demonstrated 6 patients who were on hospice who received liver transplants. So not only were they listed, they actually received those liver transplants, and while they were on the list, receiving hospice services. It's pretty huge. Now, it's a very, again, single center, a very robust service. They had their own hospice services that they could utilize, that they could help direct in the care of these patients, but pretty remarkable study. Lamba et al. In 2012 showed in the SICU patients who were peritransplant. It was pretty remarkable. Again, giving palliative consults to patients regardless of whether they were at end of life, it did not increase mortality. The mortality numbers were the same with the patients who received usual care versus concurrent palliative care. But there was an increase in time from DNR to death, and there was a decreased SICU length of stay. And so while the overall outcome was the same, you could interpret that as patients who received palliative did not die faster, they did not die sooner, they died maybe in a way that they had wanted, they died not in the surgical ICU. Very interesting, and again, a way to look at maybe a unique way that we can provide care for these patients. And then Bauman et al. In 2015 demonstrated the use of outpatient palliative for those patients who are awaiting transplant. And it showed improvement in certain symptoms, including some psychological symptoms and pruritus. So as I alluded to in that slide, it seems like a concurrent care model is one that could be utilized for these patients, where they're receiving disease-directed and palliative care simultaneously, which can then adapt as they proceed through their disease process. So really harkens back to the original hospice philosophy. Hospice was providing this level of support, this level of care to patients at all points in their disease. Unfortunately, when hospice came over to the United States, the disease-directed piece kind of fell away and we really focused on end of life. So there's been a push recently in the literature and in policy work looking at open access hospices. So those that are providing both disease-directed and hospice, or I should say, providing hospice care to patients who are also receiving disease-directed care from their respective centers. There's been a CMS study that's been looking at certain hospice agencies, really trying to characterize how is this care delivered, is it efficient, is it providing a better level of care than can be provided in the traditional model. And where it's been demonstrated most robustly in the literature is in advanced heart failure, specifically in patients undergoing LVAD, either workup or actual post-LVAD, and then the heart transplant world. So stealing a little bit from the heart transplant world, looking at something called preparedness planning. So a kind of specific advanced care planning for these patients that is specific to their disease process, specific to the challenges that they will potentially face as they're going through their care. And so looking at psychological concerns, social concerns, financial concerns, caregiver concerns, all the things that we do, all the things that are within the palliative domains in a more organized, kind of objective manner, kind of a checkbox, so to speak. So it's looking at those quality of life determinants. What are the things that these patients are looking for as they're looking at their quality of life? Looking at ethical issues. What happens if somebody receives a liver transplant and then has all sorts of life-limiting complications? How aggressive do we continue to be? What is our role? What is our ethical obligation to continue to provide these aggressive measures if we can't fix the underlying problem, if they can't get another liver transplant? All those abstracts, all those what-ifs that become very real when a patient and their family is dealing with it after the fact and they weren't prepared at all. So this helps us. So looking at transplant as life-saving but life-altering, and knowing that the palliative needs, the aggressive symptom management needs, the psychosocial concerns, they don't go away when you receive a transplant. They change, they adapt, they continue to progress as you're dealing with another life-altering issue. Your liver is fixed, but now you have a transplant, and now you have a whole nother series of issues to deal with, and palliative could help bridge going from pre to post-transplant. So looking at goals and expectations, does a patient and their family really understand what's happening? Do they really understand what they're signing up for, helping to prepare them? Looking at medical technology preferences. How many times have you had a consult where a family member says months down the line, if I had known that this is where we would end up, we never would have said yes in the first place. Now, would that be true at the time? No one can ever know, but at least it helps them have that framework so it's not a complete shock when they end up there a month later. Talking about locations of care, very simple. Would a patient accept being at an LTAC indefinitely, at a skilled nursing facility indefinitely, outside of the home, exploring those before they get stuck in an unacceptable quality of life? As I mentioned earlier, designating a power of attorney is essential, or just affirming that their legal next of kin is who they want, though I always recommend a healthcare power of attorney just to get that alternative. What happens if something happens to their legal next of kin and then they have 7 children? Maybe they need to address that so that they have a spokesperson, or so that they know that if something happens to their loved one, someone else will step in. Psychosocial assessment. We already do that for transplant. Psychosocial issues are kind of at the crux of delineating who gets a transplant and who doesn't. So if we're already doing that in our routine work, we can expand it a little bit and hit some of those palliative domains as well. Talking about perioperative morbidity and mortality, again, not to scare anybody, not to convince them otherwise, not to go through with it, but to help them prepare. It's very much in the hope and worry. We're hopeful that we're going to move forward with this transplant, and at the same time, putting some of those worries on the table allows us to be prepared. And then talking about spiritual and religious preferences, that's something that we deal with all the time in our palliative work, and it's something that's very important to a lot of patients who are dealing with not only a life-limiting illness, but a potentially life-limiting procedure. who knows what's going to happen on the other side, both spiritually and then also on the other side of the operation. And so it's important to make sure that we're paying attention to those things. So that's a very brief rundown of all the things that we can do for these patients. And the short story is there's a lot of work left to be done. There's a lot of work being done. There's an ongoing study right now looking at primary palliative services provided by hepatologists versus those provided by palliative physicians. There's a lot of work in the literature that's progressing, and I think will be a really exciting step forward for these patients. So then, very quickly, thinking back to those patients that I presented at the beginning of the talk, first we have the 45-year-old woman. She's got alcoholic cirrhosis, and she's referred for transplant workup. Can you think about what a potential role for palliative would be for this patient?
You want to pass the mic as you...
Anybody?
Managing uncertainty, so whether at this point she's too well for transplant and is kind of grappling with that, or if on the other end of the spectrum, if she's not a candidate, kind of helping her look at what her life might be like. She's really young overall, so there's going to be likely a lot of psychosocial, emotional sort of things as well.
Exactly. And that's when we do see patients who are pre-transplant or who are even on the transplant list, that's a lot of what we talk about. Kind of, what does life look like? How do I deal with it if I'm not sick enough? How do I deal with it if I'm too sick? A lot of these patients have young children. Helping them work through that, our social work colleagues can be essential supports for these patients. There may not be as much medically at this stage, but that psychosocial support is huge. So really utilizing our interdisciplinary team and helping the primary team social workers identify some of those issues as well.
So this sort of dovetails into a question that I had about this. Is there anything in place from Medicare, I guess specifically, that mandates a preparedness meeting with palliative?
No. For heart failure, yes.
Right.
So for heart failure, since I believe 2014, CMS has dictated that patients who are undergoing LVAD workup receive a palliative consult. And really, it's at the discretion of the individual centers, but that is part of the job. That has not been implemented for other disease states. I would imagine that as more and more data comes out from the heart failure literature, you know, showing outcomes with that, showing effectiveness of that, it might get adopted with other disease processes, but I'd say we're probably pretty far down the line from that. Doesn't mean that you can't do it. And it doesn't mean that if you are in a setting where you do have a pretty robust palliative service and you have some inroads with some of your hepatology colleagues or other disease states that could benefit from a preparedness planning model, it's an opportunity for not only clinical growth, but for research and for building the knowledge base and demonstrating this is what we do, this is what we've seen. And as more and more centers do that, as more and more providers become comfortable with that, that's when people take notice. A lot of times it's related to outcomes measures, and we just don't have that information yet. Any other roles for palliative you could see in this patient?
She may still also have underlying and untreated addiction that led her to this in the first place. So managing that while also managing all the other psychosocial barriers and even medications for any symptoms that she might have.
Yeah. And that is one of the many good things about the whole transplant process is their psychosocial support is pretty robust and pretty impressive. They identify these issues. They have a lot of links within the community. Doesn't mean that they can't use an extra layer of support. Another set of ears, another person helping them out, another person to talk to as they're processing through things. And sometimes, as you've seen in other disease states, it helps to have this neutral third party, this person who's not in charge of whether or not you get a transplant, but is another person to talk to about what are your hopes, what are your fears, what are the things that are giving you the most concern, and then that can be a mediator between the patient and their family and the treatment team. All right, and then our 67-year-old man, NASH cirrhosis, referred for transplant workup. Similar issues, but wondering if there are any other roles for palliative you might identify.
Sorry, guys. Thank you.
I actually had an interesting personal case that we were consulted on at the university hospital about someone who was a transplant candidate but ultimately refused. And so I think that declining a curative sort of treatment is something that all makes us pause. In this situation was someone who had a lot of grief from a loss of a family member, and so we were trying to tease out, is this complicated grief? Is there any sort of self-harm involved by kind of allowing a natural death? Or is this really what she wants, aside from all the psychological things? So it was an interesting case.
And one of our many privileges as being palliative physicians and palliative team members is we have the time to sit down and really dig. I mean, it's just like with any sort of consult, whether it's in the ICU, whether it's on a cancer patient, is the primary teams have a lot of those skills and can get a lot of that information, but we have that time. We have that time to spend with a patient. We have that time to spend with a family and really get at the motivations. To echo your point of, you know, the immediate action is why would you refuse? But getting at the reasons and figuring, well, yeah, that is in line with what their goals are, and transplant's not. And so how do we best take care of them? And going off of that, someone who's 45 versus someone who's 67, 67 is still well within the range to receive a transplant, but I would imagine, especially with NASH cirrhosis, he might have other comorbidities. He might also have bad diabetes. He might also have heart disease that medically could keep him from getting a transplant, and helping a patient and their family deal with that piece, because having transplant in mind and then not being able to can cause another set of psychosocial issues that we can help support. And then possibly identifying the role for hospice if somebody truly does, decline continued workup, or they're too sick. Trying to work with patients and families to determine, are they truly done with coming back to the hospital? Because just because you're not going to get a transplant doesn't mean that you can't continue to receive treatment. Get your varices banded, get your paracentesis, trying to support them as long as possible, but really helping support them that it's when the benefits of returning to the hospital outweigh the burden, or other way, burdens outweigh the benefits, that it might be time to talk about how hospice and similar support services could be helpful. So in summary, end-stage liver disease patients have many palliative needs. Symptom management can be affected by underlying hepatic dysfunction, so adjustments should be made when treating these patients. And then just starting to think about and explore the potential benefit of concurrent disease-directed and palliative care for these patients, with the main message of patients with end-stage liver disease have significant palliative needs and may be served by a concurrent care approach. Any questions?
Just a stylistic question back to the medications used for pain. If somebody has fairly significant liver dysfunction and mild to moderate renal dysfunction, and they had been getting mild to moderate doses of oxycodone for pain, and they had been tolerating it okay, are you more in the camp of, well, they're tolerating okay, so we keep a close eye on it, or are you saying, given the risks and what may come, let's just switch you to something now?
I myself am more of a, let's switch to Dilaudid, let's switch to oral Dilaudid. Some of it depends on the overall goals. Some of it depends on who's going to be writing for a prescription when they leave the hospital. If there is not an overt reason not to switch to oral Dilaudid, then generally I will. That being said, if somebody has rip-roaring renal dysfunction, it's which one are you going to take? Because with Dilaudid and with hydromorphone and morphine, not only are you dealing with the liver issues, but if your kidneys aren't working, you're never getting rid of the drug. So I would rather deal with the reduced metabolism than no metabolism at all, or no clearance at all, so to speak. So it's case by case, but I tend to be one who recommends a switch. Other questions? All right, thanks, guys.